Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in South Dakota Public Broadcasting Sioux Falls Studios. And our guest this hour, award-winning author and sculptor, Kent Nerburn. And he's been on tour this month as a South Dakota One Book author. Mostly he's been talking about his book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And today we invited him to a conversation about his artistic process, which is eloquently outlined in his most recent book called Dancing with the Gods. It's a meditative exploration on the sacred work of art, and it's a book that challenges as much as it inspires. So thank you, first of all, for being here with us and making time after this long road journey.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's great to get to talk about this little-known but already deeply loved literary child of mine.
Right.
I really like this book.
How did you
come
to make the transition from what people know you for as this author of Native American affairs, issues, and Native American characters, and how did you come to do this particular book?
Well, it actually took place as a result of a time in a sweat lodge on Pine Ridge on my 60th birthday, which, sad to say or proud to say, is a number of years ago now. Mm. And I was in the sweat lodge, and in the time, you're supposed to pray or at least ask for your heart to be opened. And when it came my turn, what I said is, I would like to learn to be an elder, not just an old person. And that's a real concern. I mean, I've worked in the Native communities long enough to know that the way the Native people think, and I believe it's important for all of us, is not that life is like a straight line with the period of productivity and fecundity in the middle and then a gradual glide path into oblivion where you are seen as vestigial. Instead, for them, it's a circle, and it's a cycle of seasons, and only the person in the last season can really speak with intelligence about the prior seasons and what's going on before. So I decided it was time for me to write an elder book, and that was sort of the feeling that I had when I was in the sweat lodge, and I thought, well, what can I write about? What do I know that I can speak of with authority and authenticity? Well, I've worked in the Native community for a long time, but I'm never 100% comfortable speaking of the Native experience. I would rather do the kind of book that I did with Neither Wolf Nor Dog for the Native voices to bring people along with me, and we look at things together. So we are traveling, we're fellow travelers, we're on a common journey, and I try to point out what I've seen. But very seldom do I turn and face and say, here is what I know. But as an elder, what can I do? What can I speak to and turn and face and say, this is what I know? Well, I spent 20 years working as a sculptor. I've spent 30 years as a writer. I studied, I got a doctorate in religion and art and hung around artists of all sorts for my entire life. And I realized that what I probably knew best was the artistic process. So I decided that was what I wanted to talk about. That was what I felt I could stand and face the audience with. And then there were two little events that really turned the tide on this. And the first one goes back to my time in graduate school. I was miserable. I was at Stanford. And I'd come from the University of Minnesota, and my world was the world of hunching down railroad tracks and sitting in basements listening to old blues records. And I went to Stanford. And Stanford was a suburban campus. I mean, it's a wonderful place, but it wasn't for me at that time. I felt out of place. I didn't belong in California. Everything about it seemed heading me in a direction that wasn't at all who I wanted to be. So I picked up my pen one day and wrote a letter to Norman Mailer. And I'd read a couple of Norman Mailer's books, and I liked the muscularity of his prose. And I think the big thing I liked about Norman Mailer was that he showed me a way to be intelligent without being an intellectual. And that was what I was struggling with. So I write this letter off to Norman Mailer. And lo and behold, Norman Mailer writes back. And I'd asked him, I don't remember exactly what I asked him. I think I probably said, can I come and work with you? And Norman, by all appearances, would be a very gruff fellow, but he wasn't gruff in his letter, and in his return letter. And he actually did write back. And I kept that letter. And that letter was like, it was like a piece of wreckage floating by in my life that I could hold on to. And I said at that point that if I ever achieved anything in life, I would always make sure that I touched the people that reached out to touch me. And I've stood by that. I've stood by that as a writer. I care about my readers. I care deeply about our communication. Well, I got a letter from a woman named Jennifer. And Jennifer was, she probably in her 20s. And it was a very sad letter about her loneliness, about how she felt no one understood what she wanted to do. She wanted to be a writer. And she wanted my thoughts on how, is it possible? How did you do it, Mr. Nervin? Well, Mr. Nervin is like, I look over my shoulder to see if my dad's there when I hear about Mr. Nervin. And so I decided I would write back to her, and then it hit me, no, maybe this is the time I turn and face the audience. Maybe I write the letter back to all the Jennifers, to everyone that I've met who struggles with the same questions that everyone in the arts does, and try to reach across that loneliness and that isolation and that yearning that people in the arts have to know if maybe they can do something, and is it worthwhile, is it worth trying? So that's what this book is.
How common is it for that search for connection to come from a place of sadness and longing and yearning? Do you get people who reach out from a celebratory standpoint and say, I just can't wait to do what you're doing? Or is there always this, and what do you sort of see is underneath that almost despondency?
Well, they don't, right. The celebratory ones don't reach out to me.
Right.
The ones that reach to me, they sort of see the nature of my temperament and recognize that I'm kind of someone who lives life in a minor key. And those people who are feeling the need for consolation more than the need for inspiration or celebration tend to reach out to me. And I don't know whether that's universal among among people in the various arts, but I do know that in my case, those are the ones that I notice, those are the ones that touch me the most, because they're the ones that resonate with my own struggle and my own indecision. And when I feel someone, I've always been better at dealing with people that are hurting than people that are dancing. So, that's what I do. I reach to the ones, Jennifer, I'm not betraying anything that, since no one knows who she is, was on the verge of suicide. And so those are the people. If you're going to reach back, you damn well better reach back to the people like that, because they're saying, help, I'm drowning. And you have to reach a hand to them and say, no, you're not. Here I am.
And mental health issues and suicide is such a complicated topic, so I want to be clear, I'm not simplifying, but I do want to ask about if you are artistically inclined and you can't find a way to express that, there can be real consequences to that for people. It's how important is it if you are creative, if you are artist, if you have a longing to paint or sculpt or act, that you act on that longing in some meaningful way?
Well, I talk about that in the course of the book. One of the hard distinctions you have to make, one of the hard distinctions I had to make, is the difference between being an artist and being able to act with artistry in any given field. And finding a way to act with artistry is another way of being an artist. And it's much less in our Western tradition than so the artistry in the Eastern tradition. There are people who are considered masters of anything from tea ceremonies to homemaking. And so if you can convince someone that there is artistry in everything that they do, the artistry of being a nurse, the artistry of being a surgeon, the artistry of being a car mechanic, if you can make that connection for them, then that's a start. But a lot of people think, oh, I have to produce an object. It's not merely in the practice, it's in the product that I create. And I think where we get trapped is because if you have an artistic temperament, what it means essentially is that you have a sensitivity to the world out there. Things touch you, a little more deeply, perhaps, than they do other people. And I don't say that in order to, you know, elevate the artistic temperament, but it's just the way it is. If you are someone, you know, who breaks down crying when they see a dead dog on the side of the road, or wants to jump up in a movie because you love something, who just feels things, and, you know, and we're sort of straitjacketed in our own behaviors, and we live on a very practical level. We live in kind of a square-cornered real world. We all have to. It's just the nature of the practical experience of going through day-to-day experiences. But if outside of this, you're real sentiments about life are exploding, either towards joy or sadness or some large emotion, and then you say, I have to find a way to express this. I've often thought about this when I was writing this book. It's the young girl who's sitting in her bedroom writing poetry. It's the guy who picks up his guitar and wants to make music because they're trying to find a voice. I mean, that's really what it is. They're trying to find a voice. And that's what I try to say to them, is you have to find that voice. And I can't tell you exactly how to do it, but I can tell you what it's like to struggle to find that voice. And if they do, then that's the healing moment. And so that's what I want. Ultimately, it's teaching and healing. I mean, art is about healing.
As you approached writing Dancing with the Gods, then you approach it, I'm guessing, as you approach everything, which is a desire to do it with excellence.
Absolutely.
My opinion, which is up for debate, is that this hasn't always been done well. There's a handful or so of artists mm-hmm. who have been able to write as effectively about the artistic process mm-hmm. as they are in their real writing in the world. So people mm-hmm. like Elizabeth Gilbert and Margaret Atwood and Stephen mm-hmm. King come to mind. How did you look at the responsibility of doing it well, which kind of gets into this whole idea of, you know, how do you approach your art with excellence habitually?
Well, my models really were not those particular writers. Although, like, I love what Stephen King did. I mean, Stephen King just sort of, you know, he just sits down and throws his elbows around and, you know, And it's very casual, and it's very winning. And you feel like he's just sitting in a bar with you, telling you about what it's like. Another person that meant a lot to me is Annie Dillard's book on this writing life. Annie Dillard, you know, in the world of, you know, literary and philosophical deities, I think Annie Dillard might be, you know, she might be in the top of the list for me.
She's on a different plane than Stephen King, I would argue. Yeah,
yeah. But on a different plane, yeah. But still, you know, the same sort of intimacy of expression about this is what the task is like. And I've just been reading a book by Richard Russo on writing. And again, these are people who have a casual voice. Even Annie Dillard, who I always feel like I'd say, damn, it's like she just grabs a glass of whiskey and a cigarette and sits down and starts writing, and what comes out is brilliant. Well, when I sat down to write this book, my responsibility was more to the kind of measured, reflective voice of Rilke in Letters to a Young Poet, or I think when I was younger, things like The Prophet meant a lot to me. Hermann Hesse's Narcissus and Goldman mm-hmm. meant a lot to me. And so when I sat down to write, I said, okay, I'm not writing from my most casual self. I'm writing from my most reflective self. It's a book that doesn't reach out to grab you. It tries to get you in the quiet places. And so in that way, I was really focused more on almost a poetic approach to the challenge rather than the conversational approach. And it was just a conscious effort on my part, probably because the nature of the responsibility I felt to the people like Jennifer. They were not coming from a casual, jocular position. They were coming from a point of yearning and wanting to speak from the heart to me, so I wanted to speak from the heart back to them.
How much of the artistic process is about trust for you?
Say more. How do you mean?
Trusting the process so that when you come up with a challenge and you get blocked, for example, trusting, getting out of the way to let something happen, do you think actively about trust in how you create?
I think about authenticity more than trust. My strength and weakness as a writer is that I'm a marketplace personality. I can enter into another person's consciousness and point of view pretty easily. I know where the limits are. I know where I shouldn't go. And that's one of the things in like working with the native issues, I will never transgress and assume that I know the inside of their minds. But I know how to look carefully and cautiously at what matters to people. So for me, the trust comes in trusting that my voice is authentic. And because I've got this sort of marketplace personality, I don't trust it entirely all the time. I only trust it in retrospect. You know, I write something and I write it, I pour it out. But I pour it out with as much precision and accuracy as I can. And then I leave it. And I leave it for a period of time. Maybe it's an hour, maybe it's a week, maybe it's a month. And then I look at it and either say, this is garbage and inauthentic, or I say, hey, this isn't too bad, and I can build on it. And what I'm really looking for is the point where I trust my own voice. And it can be one of many different voices. Like I said, this is a very reflective voice. The whole rhythm of the book is reflective, and it's the musicality of it, and music is very important to me. The musicality of it is languid. It's an adagio kind of writing style. And so, though if I trust the voice I have, and I don't think I'm being artificial, I don't think I'm being disingenuous, then I go forward. But it's a labor. It's a labor. I don't enjoy writing. I enjoy when I get captured by something I'm writing. But the process, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And the arid stretches are, they're anguishing, that you just, where it isn't coming out. And if it doesn't feel like I'm saying anything that I trust as being an authentic voice, I'm essentially rendered mute until something changes.
Yeah. We'll talk with more with Kent Nerburn after a quick break. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guest this hour is author Kent Nerburn, and he's been traveling the state of South Dakota talking about the South Dakota One book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. But today we have pressed upon him to talk about the book Dancing with the Gods, which is all about the artistic process in his life as a sculptor and a writer, and an invitation really to others into the artistic process. And Kent, I want to jump in here in this book when there's a section that you're talking about how some people have the sense that, you know, to shut life out in order to become a great artist. It's a chapter called The Right Stroke. And you say one of the greatest mistakes you can make is to focus completely on your art, believing that shutting out the rest of the world is the best way to achieve a clear artistic vision. It is, in fact, quite the opposite. Curiosity and openness are perhaps your most important artistic tools. In a world that is particularly noisy today, you could take that advice, you know, too far in mm-hmm. some ways and never get to the important work of sitting down and shutting things out to mm-hmm. write. Or you could, you know, sort of become a hermit and leave your relationships, for example, by the wayside. How hard was that for you to come up with the balance? Do you still work on that today? To come up with the balance between living life and creating art?
Well, let me give an immediate example. Excuse me, traveling. I've been to, 15 cities now? Or not cities, 15 locations. Some do not rise to the level of city. Some are just little towns, spots on the reservation where I know people. 15 places where I'm driving under the South Dakota skies and the South Dakota weather, just stopping and talking to people. And I mean, nobody knows who I am, you know, and that's great. You know, that if I go in to do a reading or something, they know who I am. But if other than that, I'm just a guy on the street. And it is so nourishing. I can't believe how much creative energy I draw from just the day-to-day encounters. And I need that. I need that. I think everyone needs it. People who put on the, if you're in an urban setting, let's put it that way. If you're in New York City or London and you want to act out the role of the artist, that's just fine. But art is ultimately a modality. It's a way of seeing the world and a way of shaping and framing the world. Whatever your artistry is really a response to the richness of the human experience. And if I dig way back in my memory, it seems to me it was Henri Bergson who used to talk about the eternal flux or the constant flux of human experience and how we have to choose from it. You know, if you're a house painter and you walk into a neighborhood, you're going to look at the color of the houses. If you're a dentist, you're going to look at people's teeth in a room. You have your way of looking that is predicated on what it is that's important for you. If you're an artist of any sort, what you need is the richness of experience. If I were a musician, I would have been sitting on the banks of the Missouri yesterday, listening to the birds and listening to the water. And then compositions would have come to me. And then I have to go off and find a way to frame these in. But it's, you know, emotion recollected in tranquility. That's really what it is. For me, and to me, I think that I always tell any young artist, your identity, you want the identity of an artist. You want the reinforcement of being an artist, but ultimately that's something brittle. What you really want is the richness of experience that becomes the seedbed of your creative experience. In my case, this trip has, it's set me free. I mean, I was sitting in a room not getting anything done for a number of months. And it's frustrating. You're pulling your hair out and you ask yourself, you know, is it game over? Am I done? You know, is this it? Did I deplete myself completely? But it's an inhalation and exhalation. And the creation is the exhalation and the inhalation is the experience. So to me, any experience is artistic fodder. And the more you touch the world with your senses, and that can be other people, it can be the environment, it can be the weather, but it's got to be something that says, I'm taking this in a way that I can hold it. You know, it's not note-taking. Yes, you can take a scribble here and there. Yes, you can use a tape recorder, but ultimately, it's what lodges deep in your heart, so when you sit down to create, you can go back to that and sort out all the other stuff that isn't important, but it's what you take in that allows what you produce to have, you know, have some beauty and, one would hope, some legitimacy.
Does that show up in unexpected ways or in predictable ways?
Oh, absolutely unexpected ways. Yeah. You don't know what it is that's going to make a difference, and that's why you can't limit what you do. That everyone has a pace at which they work. And I remember a very insightful professor at Stanford who was watching me as I was twisting and, you know, turning inside my own skin. And he said to me, you know, you'll never be an academic. And I said, well, why not? Not that I wanted to be, but there was and he said, because you're a walking thinker, not a sitting thinker. And ultimately what I've become is a driving thinker. That's the speed at which I take in information. And I take it in at a narrative pace. There are others who can sit in one place and stare at a garden, stare at a field, sit at a in a coffee shop and get the information they need. But for me, if I'm in motion is somewhere between 30 and 60 miles an hour, I tend to get the information that I need. And I don't know what it is. The stops are a surprise. This corner is a surprise. If I turn down a road and there's a little museum and I go into that little museum, there might be something in that little museum that keys my imagination. It might be an encounter on the street. But it It's always a surprise. If it's not a surprise, you know, then the experience ultimately isn't creative. I mean, if you set out and say, now I'm going to go have an experience, well, good luck. You know, you're not going to have much at all. You just got to bang around in the world, you know, and and then you have a good time and something comes back to you.
Do you think there are enough people banging around in the world these days?
Listen, there are plenty of people banging around in the world. Whether they're getting any outcome from it is the other issue. But I really, really like this current generation of people. I did not like that middle bunch between the time that I was maybe in my 40s and the ones to my 60s, the ones for whom success was a model. I remember one friend of mine saying that when we were kids, we'd try to decide, well, when you're in college, the question is, well, am I going to go work in a cannery in Alaska, or am I going to hitchhike across Europe, or am I going to go to Africa and work in the Peace Corps? And he said, no, they'd have to decide whether they're going to live, and this was in Minneapolis, whether they're going to live in Burnsville or Apple Valley. That to me, it can work, but it isn't banging around in the world the way that I see the young people now. I mean, people are dissatisfied. They don't like the world we've got in front of us. There's a chance for change. There's whole new ways of understanding that are coming into play that weren't in, for example, in my middle-class white male reality. People are mobile. The races are blending. People travel other places. I mean, I think there's maybe a cyber backpack. It may not be a real backpack, but they're out there again. And I think there's a lot of folks banging around. I feel creativity everywhere. Because creativity does have, it's dangerous. It's dangerous stuff. What can be produced by the creative imagination can be, it can go a lot of different directions. And I see people living on the edge in a very good way. Maybe they're driven to the edge. Maybe they can't stand the center. But I see it, and I love it. And so I'm saying, come on, yeah. Don't. And maybe that's part of this. Don't be afraid. Take your chances. Oh, if you're sitting and saying, oh, can I do it? Well, nobody knew they could do it. I mean, I'm at the top of a very tiny heap right now. But it's somewhere. And like I did, I tell the story of this strange friendship I have that I've developed with Robert Plant of the Led Zeppelin musician. And that's what is sad, is he's thought of as the Led Zeppelin musician. And like he said, his identity was defined between the ages of 18 and 24, and everyone thinks of him that way. And he doesn't have the freedom to bang around anymore. He has to go hide out in the world. But he can also, he can bang around with musicians, and that works really well for him. But to me, there's a lot of movement, and I sort of have always said, well, you got up till 30 before you have to, then you got to start tightening it down a little bit. You don't have to, but you have to be a little wary if you're not starting to tighten it down a little bit by 30. But up to that time, as long as you're not hurting other people, you're not harming old people and children and dogs, go forth and have a good time.
In that vein, you write, the risks you took earlier in your career were aimed at success, and the risks you take as you get older are aimed at expression.
Mm-hmm.
So how has aging and getting older really changed your risk-taking? What is that, what would be your advice to someone who's getting started? Can you jump ahead and take risks to expression at an early age?
Well, what I meant by that, I guess, is that expression now for me is, I recognize that my time is finite. When I was younger, I knew it was finite, but the world was an expansive reality. I wanted to be heard. I wanted to be known. And as someone who doesn't handle criticism well, someone who success has never meant anything to me. Failure's meant a lot. One of the reasons I never made it as an athlete was that I never cared about winning, but I hated losing. And so when you're young, you have to try to find a way to win in some someplace in your life. And it's unfortunate if the way that if what you consider success is simply financial success, because it ain't going to happen in the arts. That just doesn't work that way. But it's a matter of getting known, finding that your identity is worth something to you and to someone else. And when you get older, at least in most of the arts are project oriented. You know, every it's like you make something, then you move on to the next thing, and you find that your life is like, your creative life has been like a series of pearls on a necklace. And you want to complete that necklace. You want to say, okay, here are some things I left unsaid. Here are the things that I think people need to know about. Here's what my life experience has given me that I have to talk about. And it requires a different kind of courage. The courage to take chances when you're younger means taking chances to fail. And when you're older, the chances you take are chances of revelation. I think that you're trying to say some things that you think you ought to say, but you know, it's just hard to want to go that deeply into the heart and lay it out there. So again, you know, that maybe that's kind of what I mean by the difference between the goal of success and the goal of expression.
The book is called Dancing with the Gods. My guest is Kent Nerburn. We will take a break and we'll have more with Kent after that break on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guest today is author Kent Nerburn. He's been traveling the state as a South Dakota One Book author for the South Dakota Humanities Council. And today we're talking about his book on the creative process called Dancing with the Gods, Reflections on Life and Art. And we've mentioned a couple times throughout this conversation this notion of failure and risk and you know, the pain, the challenges, really. How have you learned to overcome those moments? Because anytime you put something out there, mm-hmm. even if it's just on the page and nobody has seen it yet, sure. you are the witness to when it falls flat. Mm-hmm. There are ideas that just don't develop. There are things that feel inauthentic. Mm-hmm. There are things that sometimes you just tear up and walk away from. How do you deal with that?
Well, art is such a vulnerable process. If you're doing it right, you're bringing something out of yourself and you're putting it out before the world. And whether that be a character, the way you're interpreting a character, a piece of music you've written, a piece of music you're playing, a painting, a book. And when you get it out there, you want some level of approval. And different people have different levels of need. Some are perfectly happy just to have made something and say, well, I'm done, this is done. You know, and I know people who make the astonishing statement of, if they don't get it, it's their loss. Well, I can't make that statement, and I know too many who can. Instead, it's like, is this okay? Is this okay? And when someone rejects it or demeans it or just ignores it, all the fears of your own inadequacy, and the fear, the greatest fear of all is that you're a no talent and mediocre and a charlatan come washing in on you. It's very hard to handle criticism. It's very hard to handle lack of response from what's out there. Failure has its virtues. One thing about it is that you always can keep trying. You always can keep trying, and you say, well, that didn't work. This didn't work. It's a process of seeking out a voice. And so thinking as a sculptor, there's a sculpting away of the, you know, ephemera and the things that don't work. But it takes a lot of courage. I mean, rejection is, you know, rejection's hard. I still don't like it. You know, if I submit a proposal for a book and the person who's looking at it said, know, this doesn't make it, this, you know, this sort of slogs, it bumps its tail, it doesn't take wing. There's a first sort of response of, well, you don't understand it. And the next one is, oh my God, I don't have it anymore. I think that you have to accept the fact that failure and rejection are part of the artistic experience. And so you just take it and you absorb it. You have to accept the fact also, and you have to take what you have to take solace in the fact that you've done something that other people don't do. You've created something from nothing. You have almost recapitulated the creative process of the universe. You have taken something and from a germination point and brought it forth into the world. And you have to feel good about that. And that's a broad, you know, that's a broad abstract issue. It's easier to feel good about something in an abstraction than it is to find that this thing has no voice and it has no life. But you just have to keep going. And, you know, I talked about it in terms of how I've been able to work in the Native community. Well, it also is how you work in the creative world. It's the bad cat syndrome. You just keep going back and back and back, and eventually you find a way in the door. And you find your voice. I always go back to the issue of voice. It's finding a voice. And that voice is something that comes from inside of you. When you find out that you are saying something that cannot be said any other way or that you cannot say any better, then you say, yeah, I think I've got this. And then it's just courage. It's just, you know, not letting the wounds, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune get to you. But it's hard. Failure is a very hard thing.
Are there seeds in the projects that fail, the paragraphs that fail, the characters that fail? Is there almost always something in there that you find yourself coming back to in the future? Not necessarily that you saved the piece of paper that you typed this on and then you pulled out a line, but does that sort of live, you know, in its own space, and then later you find it was reimagined in a different way?
Well, there is a clarification process that takes place. Once an idea is planted, it will grow in different fashions. But I have personally tried to take things that the things were on the cutting room floor, and tried to fit them back into something that I was writing in a contemporary voice, contemporary situation, contemporary mind. And almost without exception, I found it to be a failure. I have one friend who says that, you know, if you don't use it right away, throw it away. And I have another friend who said, put them all in a drawer, they have their purposes. And I think it does come down to temperament. I find that, again, it goes back to voice. If I've said it one time and I try to say it again the same way, then it loses its spontaneity. Things have an immediacy. And if they come out of you with a little sparkle, that you have to take that sparkle when it shows up. So I'm always filing impressions. I'm not filing necessarily particular sentences or pieces of work. I'm filing impressions. And you know the difference between when something comes naturally and is built upon everything that you've done before and when something is forced. I talk in there about the time when I was a sculptor and I was working on a large sculpture for a monastery in British Columbia. And it was their patron saint was Joseph the Worker. And so I was doing this figurative version of Joseph the Worker, and I did the left arm, and I nailed it. It came out right away. And then I took the right arm, and I didn't get it right. And I niggled it and thought it and reworked it and, you know, couldn't get the wrist right, couldn't get the relationship of the elbow and the forearm. It went from being gesture to posture. And I just, it lost any spontaneity that it had. And that was kind of a lesson to me. If it isn't alive immediately, or even if it is alive immediately, it probably has only that moment. And the sad thing is when something is really alive, but it doesn't have any place in what you're doing. You say, this is great, and I, you know, if anyone ever wanted to bother to look in my drawer, well, look in my drawer, my computer screen, 20 years or 30 years from now, they would say, what is all this stuff? I mean, if you piled it up, it's this tall. And you know what? I'll bet there's some really, really good stuff in there, but I don't know if it'll ever find its way out. It hasn't worked to me to be an archaeologist of my own work. Mm-hmm. It only works if it's got a little freshness. And that's why I'm having fun on this tour and writing and blogging, because it's like, I'm alive, I'm doing it. Yeah. And trying, you know, there is a, it's sort of a Lazarus thing. You're trying to bring something back from the dead once it's been put away. At least that's the way it works for me. And so I've just had to accept the fact that, as they say, you know, you kill your babies. And sometimes, you know, and I got some dead babies, which is a macabre phrase, but hey,
right.
People in the arts know about that. We've all got dead babies out there, so.
In some ways, that circles us back to the idea of trust and trusting that there are more ideas forward than there mm-hmm. are
yeah.
back, and that it's okay mm-hmm. to take that step forward and release the things that just didn't work.
And
that
that's why
there'll be more.
Yeah, and that's why it comes back to the question of where do you get fed? Where do you get your inspiration? What is it that that's drawing you? I mentioned in the book about like George O'Keeffe moved to the Southwest and switched to sculpture because her eyesight wasn't doing well. Which of the Impressionist painters
Monet, yeah.
Right, thank you. Yeah, I think it was cataracts he had or something, and it changed his vision. So suddenly he could see differently, he could see better. And so new information was coming to him from the outside world that he wouldn't have had before. In my case, if I'm looking at people, I see people differently than I did 20 or 30 years ago. I look at young people differently, I look at old people differently. So there's constantly new information, but you gotta go out and get the new information. You can't sit there and say, and you know, learn your own lesson here, Kent, by the way. You can't sit there and say, got this big pile of stuff and there's good stuff in it. No, there's a big pile of stuff out in the world and you better go out and try to find that because you want your work to have life. And if it isn't gonna have life, if it's essentially an excavation of your past.
Right. Okay. Will you read for us from Dancing with the Gods?
Yeah, this is just a little section at the end where it'll take you about a minute here, if we have. Do we have that?
Yes, yeah. We do. Thank you.
This is the last, the last chapter. I've spoken much, perhaps too much, about the difficulties and challenges of a life in the arts. But I've done so for a reason. I know too well the heaviness of the burden and the elusive nature of the dream. And I want to let you know that I understand and that you are not alone. But I hope I have spoken too of the joys and the magic of this life and have given you a vision of the world that awaits you when you give yourself to it. It is a life unlike any other, and those of you who choose it are privileged to live inside this rare and magical realm. Still, the life of the artist is not easy. The world will not understand you. It will praise you too much and respect you too little. It will see the grace that you have struggled so hard to achieve in your work and assume that it came easily or as the result of a God-given talent. It will assume that you are indifferent to the worldly concerns of finances and economic survival and think that the satisfaction of living a creative life is compensation enough. It will look upon you with envy because you get to live the life of the creator and regard you with jealousy because you appear to avoid the dross of an ordinary life. It will distort you in ways you cannot imagine. Can I read a bit more? A little more here.
Yes.
All right. Though these difficulties will weigh on you, they are a small price to pay for the gifts you have been given. You have learned to see the world with mindfulness because in the life of an artist, no moment is insignificant. You have been kept from cynicism because you know that work based on cynicism is heartless and callow. You have known the gift of conversing with people from different times and different lands because art is a language of the heart and the heart is universal. Most of all, you have been given the gift of endless youth because your life is based upon curiosity. And the curious never get old.
I love that. You have not lived an ordinary life, but you have embraced the ordinary in many ways.
Well, I love the ordinary. It's the lifeblood of our time on Earth. You know, and we're all just here trying to pay our rent for the time we're here. And to me, it's a celebration of the ordinary. It's ceremonies of the ordinary. So.
Do we need art?
Oh, absolutely. We need to know that there is a way of framing this world outside of us with a creative vision. And it's art is an act of mindfulness. It's an act of mindfulness to create. It's an act of mindfulness to perceive. If you read a poet, if you listen to a musician, you're hearing something that transcends our ordinary and our everyday. And you're also, the artist has the capacity to touch someone in a place where they might feel alone. It gives us a reason to say, you know, we are better than the world that we live in. We have some dreams. It's the world of the dreamer, you know, and that's what I like to say, the artists are the tribe of the endless dreamers. And to put dreams out there in physical form is just a wonderful experience. And, you know, you could say in some ways, you know, as Rodney Dangerfield would say, it ain't easy being me. But in other ways, there's no better way to live because you're giving dreams external form, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Can art in our remaining minute come from anywhere? Can it come from here, from this place, from South Dakota, from Pine Ridge, from any of the places that you stopped at? Can art that is as every bit as significant to the world come from here as it can from a major coastal city, for example?
I think more significant art comes from here because this is an authentic life. Art too often in urban centers becomes self-referential. It's artists making commentaries on other art. It's writers looking over their shoulder at what other writers are doing. It's in economic hotbeds where people are struggling. They have to be successful. Here, people create because they have something to say. And the challenge is having something to say and finding out that you can say it well. And to me, the best art comes from the big empty spaces and the quiet spaces, because art is an act of quiet, and this is a land of quiet and big skies. So I think this is a great place to create art.
Kent Nerburn, thank you so much for being here with us and giving us so much of your time. Thank you for traveling to all the places that you did for the Humanities Council and here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting for giving us your attention as well. We appreciate your work and we appreciate your presence.
I love every minute of it. Thanks so much.